You're listening to the Bird Dog Babe Podcast with my mom, Courtney Bastion.
This episode is presented to you by Purina Pro Plan and Boss Shot Shells.
If you're out there with a young dog, you may need to go in there and be the bird dog with them. And once they start producing birds left and right in those cattails, they're going to see those cattails from a ways away and they're going to want to go right in them. I mean, that's just learning. That's with any cover with a young dog. You have to bring them in there and you have to show them success. But once they learn, I mean, those cattails are brutal on dogs. I think I came home from that last week and some of the dogs had scabs on their eyes and their nose, you know, the tips of their noses were bleeding. You know, the poodle pointer that we had with, it was bleeding out of its nose because it was, every time we'd take them in the cattails, he'd break it open again. But they're brutal. Mm-hmm. I mean, but they're in there for a reason.
I want to share something pretty amazing that Purina has been involved with. It's called the Purple Leash Project, which was created in 2019 together with Red Rover, and the mission that people and pets are better together. One in three women and one in four men experience domestic abuse in their lifetime, and only 15% of domestic violence shelters accept pets. Nearly half of all victims delay leaving because they don't want to leave their pet, and over 70% of women in domestic violence shelters report their abuser threatened, injured, or killed a pet as a means of control. Today, 48 of 50 states have at least one pet-friendly shelter, and it's Purina's goal to have 25% of shelters be pet-friendly by 2025. To date, Purina has donated over $1 million to support the efforts to make more domestic violence shelters pet-friendly. To say I'm incredibly proud to be an ambassador and work for Purina is an understatement. Find out more at safeplaceforpets.org. I'm heading east tomorrow for my last hunting trip of Montana season with my money bag of Boss 20-gauge fives. It's my go-to for pheasant, late-season sharpies, and hopefully the opportunity for some ducks. And because Boss is non-tox, that's all I'll be carrying in the wetlands and uplands. Head to BossShotShells.com to order yourself some copper-plated Devastation that's delivered direct to consumer. I'm packing both of my Siren shotguns with me this weekend, the 20-gauge Tempio Light and the 20-gauge Elos D2. The cold, wet winter weather conditions call for more attention to keep our gums clean and dry after each hunt, so I plan to split the time between both of them and keep them in good shape to help increase their life and reduce the chances of any malfunctions. Go to SirenUSA.com to view the only full line of women shotguns. My Dakota 283 crates are freshly cleaned, have their wet mud mats down, with a plush bed on top of that, with the Mud River insulated kennel covers on to keep my crew warm, dry, and comfortable when they're not in the field. I have two medium G3s strapped into the back of my truck, and Angus rides in a large that's strapped into the back seat. We have wintry roads now, and even more reason to keep your dog safe during travels in a Dakota 283 kennel. Go to Dakota283.com and use promo code BIRDDOGBABE for 10% off. Today, William and I discuss late season hunting. The weather has changed and the birds have been getting pressured and educated for months. We discuss travel considerations, gear, chokes, and shot size, ideal dogs, as well as the cover, diet, and behavior of different upland species. To share their expertise insight, biologists and avid hunters Billy Peterson and Ken Plord weigh in on bird-specific considerations. All right. Let's get after it.
What is today?
The 13th, 14th?
You're like, no.
My way off?
I can't even tell. Today is December 15th.
Oh, wow.
So we have 2 weeks left.
It means it's cold and it's snowy and wet out now.
So we're going to have a little discussion about how that changes.
Well, just we're going to have a discussion on how that changes your hunting.
Late season hunting, some people that have been getting out a lot may be tired or sick of hunting. Is that a thing? That might be a thing.
Or just travel south and not deal with the weather.
Yeah.
The lucky ones.
And some just don't like to hunt in the cold. I've found that with late season hunting, there aren't as many people out there Would you agree?
Definitely not.
The birds are more educated. They've been pressured. They're going to be hiding thicker into cover than they were before. There's snow now, so several are going to be in the snow, burrowed in the snow.
Which makes a fun scenery when they pop out.
Fun and kind of
it does
startling.
It's always fun to go out on that first week of snow, if you can get out in the first couple days of snow, because it just seems like it startles the birds to a point where they don't know what to do. And I think they hold better, and you catch them off guard, and they're not sure what to do in the snow, and they don't want to run around. But just you give them a week in that snow, and they got the track shoes on again.
I like the fresh fallen snow because you can see their tracks. Yeah. So you have, I think I'm able to get more in a ready position because I know that they're coming up, or you're able to eliminate a lot of the areas where they aren't going to be.
Yeah, if you walk into cover and there's tons of fresh tracks, you know your probably chances are a lot higher.
And they're typically out in the afternoon or when it's the warmest part of the day. So maybe between 10 and 3, they've been feeding or they're just getting ready to feed and then go back for the night. But also the type of cover. You want to be more specific when you're searching for habitat because they're more apt to be in those thicker, brushy areas than they are in the wide open like you would find in early season.
Yeah, I think that's bird specific too, though. But you're less apt to have them out on the prairie. Sharptails you may still find out there feeding, scraping the ground. But more times than none, you're going to be finding them in the brushy habitat and the Russian olives and in the bushes, and the pheasants will definitely be moving into the cattails and those thicker covers.
With the cooler temperatures, I think it's more ideal hunting conditions for the coated dog breeds. So the wire hairs love to hunt in the snow.
Yeah, they do much better.
Whereas the Broncos, they're getting a little chilly.
Yeah, or any of the short-coated breeds can get a little bit more chilly.
And it also changes up your gear. Should we jump into gear first?
Sure, let's knock that out.
So winter gear is all about the layering.
Yes.
the first layer, you want to do like a light moisture wicking, something to keep you warm and dry.
Your core, like if you have a long johns or some wool or some merino wool liner, that's
merino wool is good
for a base layer.
And then that middle layer is going to be your warmth. Like, give an example of what you wear as a middle layer.
Well, I would wear just my long sleeve wicking shirt over top, and my base layer is going to keep my core warm.
Mm-hmm. So, like your dry released?
Yes.
Okay.
Over top of my my merino wool base layer.
Mm-hmm.
And then over top of that, it's going to keep the wind and the weather off me. So, because it's going to keep me drier.
And then outer layer, so like a light, really flexible, so nothing too heavy, but that's going to give you that windbreak, windproofing, because I think being out in the prairies, when you have that wide open area, that wind gets pretty bitter and brutal.
Yeah, and that's the layer you may be taking on and off. If you're down in without not hitting the wind, you might want to take that off because you're just going to heat up too fast. But when you get up on the tops of those hilltops, you know, you're going to catch that wind and you're going to feel that chill. But if you're hunting cattails and stuff in the bottoms all day, you probably don't need that outer layer at all.
I like just to wear that puffy vest.
Yeah.
As long as I feel like if my core is warm and my hands and my feet are warm, then I'm pretty good to go.
Yeah, it goes back to, like, I think you've made this comment before. If you leave the truck warm, you're dressed too warm. You want to leave the truck cold, and once you start walking and moving and stuff like that, you're going to warm up regardless. Like, we were out just a few weeks ago in really cold, snowy weather, and I did not have an outer layer. I didn't need it. I had my base layer, and I just had my dry release shirt, and I did wear a vest, but that came off real quick. I did get a little wet, but when we were moving all day, I didn't notice it until we stopped at the end of the hunt of the day, and then our bodies kind of, and our clothes kind of just froze. But during the whole hunt, we were warm, and I mean, we were a little wet, but that moisture wicking stuff took all that away, and I didn't feel it on my skin, and it wasn't cold during the hunt.
I remember, what was it, last year on our anniversary hunt in November, and it was so bitter cold, and we both just kind of had only our eyes showing. We had our buffs pulled up, usually till probably midday.
Yeah, until the sun finally peeked its head out.
Mm-hmm, we had the buffs pulled up. We had warm hats on. I always have extra covering over my ears. I usually use the headband for that because I have really sensitive ears. If wind gets in there, it's excruciating.
I really like those buffs, and I just keep them on my neck, too, just to keep the snow out and just keep my neck warm.
And I really like the Wild Rags for that. So it's like just a 42-inch silk scarf that you don't sweat in. I even like wearing them early season, but it keeps me really warm.
See, I haven't tried one of those. Maybe I'll try one. Maybe that'll be a new thing for next year.
The Wild Rag?
Yeah.
Yeah.
If they get a manly one, yours are pretty girly.
They are. This is a good time to kind of review the importance of waterproof boots, because once those get wet, that makes for a long day of cold, wet feet.
Yeah, and that comes down to socks, too. If you have a good merino wool sock that's going to moisture wick all that out, you're not going to feel wet and cold, even if you fall through the ice and the cattails, which we did a couple weeks ago. I went all the way past my knees, so I know I was wet, but I didn't feel wet. But
and the boot dryer. Pack the boot dryer if you have means of electricity. Yeah. Although there are some that are battery operated, isn't there?
Well, I forgot my boot dryer last week, and luckily my hunting partner he was kind of trying out a new product. It was out of the UK. It was, I think it was. But what it was is like a big silicone pack that was in a plastic boot-shaped piece, and you put that in your boot, and it just naturally dried it out, which makes it really cool because you don't need electricity, you don't need batteries, and it just dried the boots out. It worked really well.
I'm gonna have to look that one up.
And then it comes with a little dry bag, and you put it in the dry bag because if you leave them out, they'll just keep collecting moisture wherever they are.
Okay.
And then to recharge them, you know, you just put them on a hot heat source or whatever, but they worked really great. We had them all week. We didn't have any electric boot dryers or anything. They worked great.
One of the newer accessories we tried a couple of years ago, we are using every season too, and in the snow that gets pretty slick is the yak tracks. Those are a nice little addition to put on your boots. Although you have issues keeping yours on, don't you?
All the new ones I got fit better, but yeah, I'll lose them every once in a while, which you might. But, you know, when snow falls and you got to be careful, everything becomes slicker. Everything you touch, like even stepping on logs and stuff, you know, you just got to think about it when you step on it. They get slippery. I don't know how many times I fell down last week. I think we quit counting after a while. We just giggled, and there's another one. Climbing up hills become a challenge. Everything's a little different. So you're going to be hitting the ground, and your pants and everything's going to be hitting the elements a lot more than they normally would.
So packing more clothes as well, knowing that your pants are going to be getting wet.
Yeah.
And if you don't have means to be able to dry them overnight, just pack more pants. Because or else I'll sometimes wear the same pants for a couple days in the early season, but that's not going to be the same.
If you get a decent pant with the right materials, they dry out really quick. You just hang them up at night and they'll dry out.
Which kind of comes to the sleep accommodations. So I was using the iCamper this season, but as I make my way back out for my final trip to Eastern Montana this weekend, I rented a Forest Service cabin. There's no electricity, there's no water. I hope there's heat. There should be heat. That's kind of the point of it.
Well, most of the forest cabins are usually run on a fireplace or a wood stove.
Right.
Some of them, which I do believe the one you got is propane heat, which will be nice. And it probably has a wood stove, too. You might want to bring some wood. But they stoke up pretty good. I mean, people can really get in there and in really cold weather, and it's fine. So I think you'll be fine that way.
So that's actually an important point you brought up, is it's actually a better idea not to bring your own wood from home and to get wood from that area.
So pick some up in the local area.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. But yeah, so I still might sleep in the camper on the way out there. It's supposed to be 22 degrees during the day on Friday, so it'll probably be even colder at night.
I think you got one warmer day.
We'll see how well that new insulation cover works in there. You put it to the test. I am going to pack the Mr. Heater, though. That's for sure. Just in case. Need to turn that on for a little bit. But else, hotel accommodations.
Hotel options. Yeah. If you have a camper with heating and stuff in it, it's good. Just make sure that you're not... It still needs to be winterized in a way. I mean, unless you have a winter package in some of those campers.
Let's talk a little bit about rough grouse hunting. What is going to be more specific to rough grouse later season than early season?
I think it's a little different depending upon where you're at in the country. But grouse are going to be moving into different habitat. They're going to go away from, and they're going to start looking for their winter habitat, which is a lot of blowdown. I've always found in the Midwest it's more blowdown, which means trees falling, and they're going to kind of burrow in. And they have their little ground burrows, and they'll get up inside there, and they're not going to be in the normal covers that you're normally going to see them in September and October.
In the thicket down by the riparians, because we did that. We walked that for about, an hour, and we didn't have any luck. And then when we turned around and went up on the hill on the way back to the truck, they were all up there.
They're usually close to that because that's still a source of food and still a source of water. So, but you may need to think a little bit outside the box and go look in the surrounding areas. And your luck may be a little better.
And the food they're eating is a little bit different now.
Yeah. You got to look at it as a shopping list. What's the most appetizing thing down to the least appetizing thing? And you have to be kind of aware and look around and what's available to them in that area. So if there's usually, I always found snowberries are usually the last thing that they'll eat around this area. So if there's anything little red or red berries and stuff, you know, I would target that stuff first because if they're still there and available, that's where they're gonna eat those first.
Mm-hmm.
If there's any greens still available, they're gonna eat those first. Obviously, the insects and stuff are all gone. The last things they're gonna eat are like buds and the little buds and stuff towards the end there.
Mm-hmm.
Hazel brush in the Midwest,
and they don't carry a lot of fat through the winter, so they're not going to be moving around as much like they were earlier season. Although it was interesting, right now we just had our first snow that's actually sticking within the last week here, and so the grouse that we got into the other day, there was actually a good amount of fat there as they've been storing up.
Yeah, it was a more fatty one than I've seen. It was an older bird, a smarter bird. I mean, I think the older birds are smarter. They know exactly where those food sources are, the more nutritious ones. I bet if you would have got into a young one, it might have been full of snowberries because there was a lot of snowberries there. But the longer those birds live, the more educated they are, and they keep those food banks knowledge to themselves, I think.
You were surprised to see the amount of fat that was actually around the cloaca.
Yeah.
That was strange.
Yeah, it was...
It was kind of like by the wings and then inner thighs and then at the cloaca.
Mm-hmm. When I was cleaning out, gutting it out, there was a bunch of fatty sac in there, which was you normally don't see. He was ready for a long winter.
I think, too, you know, when we got into that area of birds. There was, would you say, maybe three or four there?
It's hard to say. Three for sure. There might have been four.
We heard them, didn't necessarily see them, but also, you know, as these birds are getting ready to go in the winter, it's good to remember that these are going to be our birds for next season. I'm personally not keen on chasing down every bird I hear flush and going to find it. I think I'm happy with one bird if I'm out.
Yeah.
As of right now, so.
That's just like, going on with something else, not grouse hunting. It's just like if you're going out to hunt covey birds, I do this not just at the end of the year, year round.
Right.
I hunt with an over and under or side by side. I have two shells, and I give that covey that opportunity. If I hit one, I leave it alone. If I hit none, typically I still leave it alone. But if I'm lucky enough to get a double, I'm definitely leaving it alone. But I'll also take into effect of how big is that covey to begin with. If it's a small covey to begin with, if it's like three or four huns that get up, typically I might not even take a shot.
Mm-hmm.
I'll just leave it alone. And if it's a covey of 10 to 15, then I'll try to shoot two, but I'm not going to chase those down. I'll leave those for another day.
Last year we saw hitting someone late season that was had a limit of huns. it was sad.
Yeah, yeah. Or even that when we went out together with the kids that day and we stopped and got lunch and the guy at the counter asked me, well, what are you hunting? I'm like, oh, we're just going to go chase some grouse. And he told me a story about them going up and finding some grouse and they saw seven and they killed all seven of them.
Mm.
So I took it upon myself to say, well, that's not very good for conservation because now that family group is gone. There will not be birds in that area next time you go look.
Mm.
It's not necessary to take all that out. It just doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
And I think I took him by shot. He was a younger kid, so hopefully it made an impact and I'll think about that kind of stuff going on in the future, but now my son heard it, so I hope he picked it up.
And for the simple fact that William and I definitely aren't specialists of any sort, I asked someone much more educated in the subject to weigh in on late-season ruffed grouse hunting. Bailey Peterson, a wildlife biologist and avid hunter in Minnesota, weighs in on this topic.
In the late season, we're really going to target more of the heavy conifer cover that's adjacent or nearby to a food source. So food is super important, but we'll start with cover because it's equally important. Cover over here in the Lake States or in the Great Lakes area tends to be a conifer. Pine species that are young or middle-aged provide a big canopy, but what I target a lot of is spruce and balsam fir. They have a really wide base. Just picture like your typical Christmas tree. What it's going to do is provide cover when there's unfavorable roosting snow. So snow that's a little too crusty or hard for them to dive into and roost under the snow, or maybe there's not enough snow for them to roost. Those conifer trees are going to have less snow underneath them than a spindly or dog hair thick type aspen cover or out in the wide open. And they also will kind of hang out in those trees just to roost during the daytime quite often or even overnight. Up until today, we had very good roosting snow. We had about 12 to 15 inches of soft, fluffy snow, which was just perfect for making snowballs all over my dog's feathering. But when it's that soft and fluffy, it is perfect for them to just dive right into. And we were seeing, they were not even walking hardly anywhere. They would have like a short runway where they would walk, they'd come out of their roost, walk maybe 3 to 5 feet and then take off into, I can only imagine they were heading into an aspen or a birch tree to feed, or maybe into a conifer tree to hang out for the day, but they weren't spending any time on the ground at all, which means they were kind of tucked in cozy, kind of helps them thermal regulate in those snow roosts. And it also keeps, they're much more protected from predation too. It's a lot harder to smell them down there. But they enter those snow roosts by kind of landing on the ground and just like fluffing up the snow around them and just kind of settling in, or they kind of dive in a little bit just to make a big impact.
What about diet? What are they eating now later season?
So over here, their diet is switched from soft mast, which was, you know, their leaves or berries or mushrooms, to more primarily hard mast, which is catkins. On the species I target the most are hazel species, beaked or American hazel, and birch, which is paper birch. Or over here, we have a lot of yellow birch, which I don't know if there's anything to it, but I think it's like grouse candy because I target yellow birch quite often in the fall and find birds associated with it a lot. And then, but the most typical winter grouse food that we know of or think of is aspen buds. So you can see them up in the aspen trees right at sunset feeding before they dive down in their snow roost for the night. Or if there's not enough snow for roosting, we find them. That's when they go and tuck in underneath a conifer. It holds the heat in too. You'll find that conifers have less snow underneath them because the snow can't fall through the heavy branches, but it also helps hold the heat closer to the ground. Makes sense. It's just a lower ceiling.
What about the best time of the day to find them right now?
If you want to have a experience that'll give you a bit of a heart attack, you go out right away in the morning and try to have the dogs work the snow roost. It's such an amazing sight to see a dog pointing a grouse, and you look ahead of them and think they're crazy, and then you take a step forward and it's burst out of a snow roost from right next to you. It's pretty crazy. But I like that hour right before sunset. I think that's when they tend to be more active heading out to feed for the night.
What about any other behaviors that may be different? Are you just noticing that the birds are holding tighter in general later season than early?
One thing for sure that can kind of make them vulnerable depending on your style of hunt is that they do group back up. In the early season, you're getting covey flushes of family groups, and that's kind of usually like an explosion. But if you, in the late season here, get them grouped up in trees, then they don't necessarily flush out of there too readily, which does leave them vulnerable. And it kind of gets into the ethical debate of additive and compensatory mortality, which is a big rabbit hole that I don't know if I'll go down. One other tip could be, you know, looking for tracks, because this is the only time of year that you can find tracks in the snow. So if you're working like a young dog like I am this year, you can avoid running down a hare track or know when your dog might be working a grouse track and know when you're in business there.
Although I really like the pelts of the white hare right now. So earlier, any other time in the season, I'm not really willing to take a rabbit, but now that it's later season and they're white and I'm enjoying a nice hot bowl of rabbit chili, I'll take one.
I've been having a hard enough time finding my white dog in the snow this year. I know that some snowshoes have buzzed past me, but I keep missing them.
What about pheasant? What are you noticing late season pheasant, besides that they're all running to the cattails right now? Yeah. It's tougher to get in. Yeah, we have some dogs that aren't like the Bronco, so... Well, one Bronco will kind of see that as cover, and she doesn't want to go into it. But I think some dogs see that as a wall, thicker stuff. They just don't really want to get tangled into it. And whereas some of the other dogs are happy to go bust through there. But then you have that problem of the dog standing in the thick cattails on point, and I'm not going in after them. You usually do. You're a hardcore bird dog yourself.
And especially with the young dogs. I mean, those dogs aren't going to understand that there's birds in there until they find them inside there. So,
you know, you wanna take
if you're out
there
with a young dog, you may need to go in there and be the bird dog with them. And once they start producing birds left and right in those cattails, they're going to see those cattails from a ways away, and they're going to want to go right in them. I mean, that's just learning. That's with any cover with a young dog. You have to bring them in there and you have to show them success. But once they learn, I mean, those cattails are brutal on dogs. I think I came home from that last week and some of the dogs had scabs on their eyes and their nose, you know, the tips of their noses were bleeding. You know, the poodle pointer that we had with, it was bleeding out of its nose because it was, every time we'd take them into the cattails, he'd break it open again. But they're brutal. Mm-hmm. I mean, but they're in there for a reason. But I find pheasants start to group up a little bit more. They're easier to target. You know, if you find a cattail slough, that's typically where they're going to be.
Wetland edges.
Yes.
Evergreen. thick evergreen tree lines yet.
Bushy areas, yeah, mm-hmm. brushy areas. I think we found a spot where it was surrounded by brush on both sides, and then the bottom was completely cattails, and we saw a lot of birds come out of there. When we first took a first step in there, I think probably, I'd have to say 15 to 20 birds got up right away. Mm. And then, you know, you look at yourself like, well, was that all of them? And we continued to hunt, and we continued to put up birds throughout that patch. But, yeah, they're going to group up a little bit more than normal in the winter.
But that's kind of the best part of pheasant hunting in the winter, because it's all frozen.
Yeah.
Or at least you hope it is till you fall through.
It wasn't quite frozen enough for us, but...
but then you're actually able to get in there.
Yeah.
Instead of getting mucked down with swampy.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a bonus.
But with that, we also found a lot more porcupines in that weather, because they weren't moving around. They were hunkered up in those cattails as well. That same hunt, we found five.
What'd you have? Three out of the eight dogs got quilled?
Just two.
Two of
actually,
them?
Actually, the poodle pointer got a couple in there. He was just curious.
And then Tori and Carmen?
Mm-hmm. They got into it once. And then they started to point them, which was fine, but got into quite a few of them. So that's just something to be aware of and to make sure you're packing them, because they're going to be sitting tight.
What about sharp tails?
That comes down to what area you're in, but they typically are very educated this time of year. They'll see you from a mile away. They have their few birds up in the tree, and the covey may be on the ground, or the birds may be on the ground, but when those birds and those bushes on the top, they're looking for you, and they see you, they take off usually within a few moments after that first one gets up. The rest of them are gone.
Mm-hmm.
But it's always, if you see that single bird or maybe just two birds leave an area, don't think that they all left. I would hightail it over there and try to get the dogs right there, because sometimes the covey may still be there.
Mm-hmm.
Or in close proximity of it.
And this would be a good time, the late season, when you're working those closer working dogs, that they're not that far out there.
Yeah, they don't like pressure this time of year.
Mm-hmm. Do you notice that you see them more perched in the trees than you do on the ground in the winter than you do early season?
I find that they're definitely in the brush, in the trees. We saw quite a few coveys just in big pine trees.
Yeah.
And, five or six of them would fly out, and I'm like, all right. Or like the brushy areas, they'll be in that thicker area, protect from the wind and snow and whatnot. And there's some food sources in there, but there's going to be on the tippity tops of those things on high alert.
And larger size coveys late season than early season?
I have found that they are grouped up more. Like some of the coveys are pretty big.
Mm-hmm.
But you'll still find your little ones here and there, but for the most part, they are in large groups.
And I think they're more apt to be the ones burrowed in the snow than some of the other bird species. I don't see as many huns and pheasant in the snow as I do sharp tails.
Huns are a true covey bird, so they're going to be, and they're rough and tough. I mean, sharp tail are too. But you'll still find some huns just sitting out in the middle of a cut cornfield with barely no snow. They'll just be covied up right in the middle of the wide open field. Like, you can drive by and see it out there. And there's no way you can get to them because they'll see it from a mile away.
Mm-hmm.
But most of the time you'll find them on corners and edges of those brushy fields, right on the edges of those wheat fields and stuff like that. They'll still like their cover too.
And now we have Ken Plourd, the Upland Game Bird Program Habitat Specialist for Montana FWP, sharing the facts and truths on late-season pheasant, sharptail, and hun in eastern Montana.
You know, the big thing with pheasants is the landscape really shrinks for them down to available winter cover, you know, cover that somewhere that's kind of a little more out of the wind, a little warmer. So in this part of the state, usually that either means thicker shrubs, shelter belts, native brushy patches, or cattail stands. If it's nicer out, you know, things definitely ebb and flow. Certainly like a mild winter like last year, sometimes thick grass stands, riparian grasses can be enough. Other times if things get really snowy and drifted in, You know, the habitat really shrinks to those big patches of woody cover. So it can be variable, but certainly as soon as the snow and cold show up, you're not going to see stuff out in CRP as much. Definitely looking for stuff that's harder to walk through, and usually a little more thought into hunting it.
Yeah. And now with the snow on the ground, they're not all around the riparian, the water in general, like they were earlier season, especially we had a really hot September, and I felt like you were pretty much in the money or at your best odds if you were close to some water at all.
Yeah, definitely. You know, certainly riparian areas aren't a bad choice if there is, again, cattails or some really thick grasses. But the other thing, certainly, especially as with pheasants, is that they're going to start being more tied to food sources, which for them is generally crop fields. You know, I think pheasant distribution in the state probably ties pretty closely to where there's winter cover and some grain food sources. There are certainly some birds that'll be out there eating on natural foods here and there, but it's a little more rare. So anywhere you can find those two things in close proximity. So again, okay. Native shrubs, some of those draws run right up to crop fields, and the same as some of those nice thick riparian areas. And that's certainly where things seem to kind of narrow down to. Those other habitats kind of get ignored or are really just unlivable once it gets started, it's getting really snowy and cold and windy.
Is there any specific food for them that we should be targeting when we're looking? If like our, like the rose hips, if we see that kind of a thicker area, or what do you?
My sense is most of the game birds in this part of the state, you know, pheasants, grouse and huns specifically are going to kind of take advantage of whatever they can. Each species might be a little bit different. Certainly waste grain is a go-to for kind of all of them. If they can get to grain, you know, wheat, peas, whatever, they'll do so, you know, especially if they live close by. But at the same time, yeah, certainly berries, if they can get them. Russian olives, where those exist, are pretty popular for all our game birds. So many regulars to, you know, Eastern Montana know that if you can find some of those old Russian olive stands, there's probably something in there munching on those. So certainly some of those berries or, you know, soft mass type food sources can be key, along with you know, grain fields.
Okay. What about for sharptail? Are they doing anything differently when there's snow on the ground?
So yes, definitely. You know, I think it's fairly well known that often they're going to start to group up into bigger flocks in winter. You know, there's a kind of a time period early on and into the middle of the season where it's usually not as hard to get on them, but they get wise and there gets to be more eyes towards this time of year. So they often group up into winter flocks, sometimes, you know, more than 50 birds easily. And usually, at least in my experience, they'll start to kind of spend some more time flying around, going from kind of patches of winter cover. They're not afraid to fly a mile or more to, you know, from a good patch of winter cover to some food source, whether it's grain or a better berry patch, or you'll see them perch in trees a lot. They will eat on tree buds, you know, especially cottonwood. And so they're similar in pheasants in some ways, but they, I don't know, they're always a little harder to get to at this time of year. And the other thing, especially in the right weather, if there's good snow in, especially in certain CRP fields and they can snow roost, you do see sharptails doing that a fair amount. So it depends a little bit on the weather, but if there's the right amount of snow and it's not going to be too windy or nasty, I've definitely seen them hang out, still kind of out in some of that open country where maybe most of us wouldn't expect to find a game bird. I've seen them spend quite a bit of winter out there, and as long as it's not, you know, actively storming.
Yeah. And what about Hungarian partridge?
So huns are probably similar to pheasants. I think they might be maybe a little bit better at winter in some senses. As long as they have a good patch of winter cover and usually some sort of food source nearby, which is most often for them, at least in my area, some form of grain or, you know, field, they seem to get by all right. So that's usually where I see them, is somewhere there's brushy cover and some sort of crop somewhere within the probably 100, 200 yards, which really isn't too similar a lot of times from where you're finding them other times a year. You know, I know at times they can be kind of way out in the prairie in wild spots, but my guess is some of those probably have to move at some point to something a little more protected once the snow flies.
What about the best time of the day to go out and find them? Early morning, midday, right before sunset?
I think it all depends on how cold you want to be and what the weather is outside, maybe more than what the birds are doing. You know, certainly on those cold days, they'll be feeding actively a fair bit. You know, especially dawn and dusk, they'll get out there quick and hit food sources and then maybe go rest in some of that cover. But I don't know there's a necessarily really better time of day. It seems like if you're hunting those right covers or in close proximity to food, you're probably going to be close enough and able to figure out where they are.
Okay. Any other interesting behaviors besides, you know, coving up more later season? What else are you seeing generally with the birds?
You know, that's probably the most interesting thing and maybe the most exciting for late season hunters is, you know, you certainly see it with pheasants packed into, you know, big patches of winter cover, whether it's cattails or a shelter belt. You know, you do have the opportunity to see quite a few birds in one flush if you can get close enough, which is the question. Kind of the same thing with sharp tails. Sometimes you can get some, you know, some good action if you're lucky. You know, certainly in some places people also take the opportunity to pass shoot grouse. It's a little harder with sharp tails maybe than some other prairie grouse species, but if you kind of do know their habits and spend a little bit of time in a day or two in a spot, you might notice some different opportunities. But otherwise, you know, it's still the same bird hunting, just a little harder walking usually in a bit of snow and a few more layers on.
What has been your kind of overall synopsis of this season? Was it a little bit more tougher than your previous ones?
It seemed to go pretty well for me, and most of the hunters I talked to seemed to have pretty good reports. We definitely saw more hunter pressure up here. That was pretty clear. I think with some other areas of the state in drought, more folks came here is maybe my sense. So that was noted by a lot of people. But at the same time, most folks I talked to seem to have relatively good luck on birds in this part of the state. You know, that it's always a mixed bag. I probably talked to as many happy hunters as unhappy ones. But it seemed like for the weather and season we had, you know, it'd be hard to complain about what we had. Certainly open for a little more moisture this winter and spring and a good season next year. But all in all, I don't think it was bad at all for most folks.
One of the best tools to help get into birds in the late season is Onyx Maps, the number one hunting GPS app. When all you can see is snow-covered ground, I like to use the crop data layer in Onyx to find out what the birds are after under the snow. And as Ken just mentioned, the diet of many upland birds consists of agricultural crops, so knowing which types are planted where can lead to a more successful hunt. I'll be on the lookout mainly for wheat, corn, and sorghum fields with Onyx this weekend. Head over to onyxmaps.com to find out more.
What are you doing different for chokes? You changing out chokes differently than you were early season?
Yeah, I usually will go a little tighter, but that all comes down to your comfort zone. If you don't want to take a 50-yard shot, then don't take a 50-yard shot.
Yeah.
But I will put both barrels down a little tighter, typically in the late season.
And still using Boss 5s?
Still using, actually I'm moving to Boss 5s.
Oh, yeah. What were you using before?
7s.
On pheasant?
Well, no. On sharpies and
on hunts. Sharpies. Oh, yeah. That's true. Pheasant, you're always using 5s, right?
6s and 5s.
Okay.
6s or 5s, yeah.
But you're going huns and sharp tail at 5s now, late season.
Mm-hmm. I'll just keep one shell. I don't want to mix my pouch full of different shells. I'll get it confused.
What are you preferring out of curiosity, 20 gauge or 28 gauge late season? Or doesn't it matter?
I don't think it matters.
What about dog consideration? different types of coats that make a difference?
Well, we touched on it a little bit. Those double-coated breeds now are going to excel because the elements aren't going to bother them as much.
The snow. Now we have the snow effect. So what we notice now that I have my first low-riding bird dog, that she had all the snow attached to her inner thighs, her belly, and I think after I posted a picture of it, I had a couple good suggestions that to use PAM spray. Musher Secret was another one. And we've always used, like, the Shosheen or Cowboy Magic.
Cowboy Magic, yeah.
On, like, in the wire hairs when we hunted more in the Midwest where there are a lot of burrs.
Yeah, you're going to have to. We haven't really took her out a ton.
Yeah.
But she's going to be a burr magnet in the early season. So that's something to think about the Cowboy Magic and spraying them up before you go out, just for ease of having to take all those tangles out. But feet. I mean, feet are the thing that's going to, on your dog, is what's really going to prolong your hunt. The snowballs get in the hair of the paws, and it can hurt. It can actually make their paws bleed, and a lot of dogs will stop and lick and try to get that those snowballs out, which actually makes it worse because they're getting moisture in there, and then it freezes up, and then you have ice balls on there. It's like you think about your dog's going to be walking on like a golf ball, and that's got to be painful. So that's where the Mustard Secret and that kind of stuff, or even boots. I mean, putting boots on the dog to keep those ice balls out will make a big difference if your dog takes boots.
Mm-hmm. And also dogs, as we were talking earlier, of us falling through the ice, when the dogs fall through the ice, or last year, late season, you shot a pheasant over water and had a dog go retrieve it, and he ended up
a little cold. We ended our hunt right after that.
He had to actually carry him back to the truck
just for a precaution. Didn't want to, he was cold. You could tell. You got to look at those precautions. You look at those signs in a dog, you know, they could be shaking with excitement. It doesn't mean they're cold, but you got to really look at their hair. Sometimes their hair, especially in the short coated breeds, their hair will start to raise up. That's not a good sign. That means they're really cold. And the dog may not quit, you know. Some of them will quit and say, I'm done, I'm cold. But a lot of them have so much heart, they're just going to keep going. So you have to be that person that says, okay, that's enough. You know, let's put them away. Or maybe you need a neoprene jacket or something to keep their core a little warmer. It all depends on what you're hunting, where you're hunting, especially the waterfowlers out there. If you're going to be breaking ice for your dog and sitting there in the cold, you know, some dogs' coats will be great, and some, you know, you just have to be prepared for that.
One of the perks of hunting with snow is you don't have to carry as much water.
Yeah, I didn't care hardly any. The dogs don't even come in and check for water. You know, they'll get, if they find water out there, that's great. Otherwise, there's so much snow. They're just constantly, as they're running, they're dropping their mouth and grabbing snow as they go. I don't think the dogs asked for water at all when I was out to go, which is, takes a little weight off my back.
Mm-hmm. Literally.
Yeah.
Gun care. So I had the comment because that someone wrote, when I was hunting, snow was falling. It was very wet. And I've heard this concern a couple times, or a comment with people saying, I can't believe you carry that gun when it's snowing, or carry that gun when you're chucker hunting. And, you know, I beat up on it, but I have a great gun, more high-end gun, just like I have great high-end bird dogs. And this is, you know, my hobby. This is what I love to do. And I want the best that can help me have fun and successful in this sport. And, you know, there's always the concern that dogs could get that wear and tear or get hurt and, heaven forbid, die hunting. But that's what they're for. Yeah, I have a gun to hunt and I have the dogs to hunt. And I'm not going to put bubbles around either of them.
No, the gun is a tool. I wouldn't call my dog a tool, but in a way they are when you're hunting, but they're still part of the family. But when it comes to gear and your gun, they're made to be used. They get a little wet, they get a little dirty, but that just comes down to care and taking care of your stuff. You know, when you're done with the hunt, you'll wipe it off. I was out hunting with a guy a couple weeks ago and wasn't really used to that kind of stuff. And I was pulling out these silicone rags and spray and making sure I broke it apart, dried it out at the end of the night. And it's just an extra step that you have to do when you're out in those elements all day.
Take it completely apart and let it dry out, or clean it, wipe it down.
Take it out, wipe it down.
Run the boar snake through
them. Give it some lubrication and let it sit out and get all that moisture out of there, and they're fine. But you can't just keep a wet gun and throw it in a case and throw it in your car and keep it in the truck all night, and it's going to be froze up in the morning. And it's just, that's when you start getting damage to your gun. That all comes down to housekeeping.
Bisto turned 13 yesterday, so he's talking to us in the background. He wants everybody to know it was his birthday. And now he fell asleep. So what are some of your late season hunting plans?
We don't have 2 weeks left here.
Here, yeah. Are you going duck hunting tomorrow?
I'm going to try to get out now that I just had a realization that we only have 2 weeks.
I know.
I'll probably go out and do a little duck hunting tomorrow. Maybe take the kids out on a couple walks. See what happens. You're going to be gone.
Yeah. I'm going to watch the weather. It's supposed to kind of be crummy on the drive out there. But I've been working a lot this season. Last year I was spoiled, getting in more hunting days than I ever had in the past. And I don't know that I'll ever have a season like that again. It really was amazing. This year I haven't been able to get out as much, but I'm grateful to have work. And the cool thing is I don't think I've hit the same piece of area twice this year. That was kind of a goal, is try somewhere new and continue to find new places. And so that's been fun for the times that
if you're going to get out. Totally different area this week, which is good. I've never been down in that area, so I'm kind of curious to see what it's like. But the longer we're here, hopefully we'll have spots that we're like, there's a couple spots we haven't even hit yet.
We're very blessed with the areas around us. But yeah, I did. I woke up the other morning at 4 a.m. ready to get on my early flight, and I realized, wow, we have 2 weeks left of Montana.
Yeah, you called upland season. You messaged me and said, "Hey, because I was picking her up at the airport. Can you bring my hunting stuff in, and we can go hit that cover and see if we can find?" I'm like, "Yeah." Sure.
We have 3 hours. The kids are at school for 3 more hours. Let's go do it. But yeah, that was a good time. So yeah, I'm gonna head to Eastern Montana. I have no idea what birds are there, if there's gonna be birds there, but
well, I'm sure there'll be birds there. You'll just have to find them.
Yeah. So I'm looking forward to trying that. And then in January, the dogs have some health testing, so I'm going to head over to Spokane for that. And on the way, do a little bit of Idaho hunting, do Spokane health testing, and then head over to Oregon for some chukar and quail, hopefully.
Yep, we're lucky to be, our season here in Montana ends January 1st, but we're lucky to be surrounded by a couple states that have an extra month of hunting. So Washington, we could buzz over there and do some hunting there for the extra month, or Idaho, and do some hunting over there.
You get to go to California. You're going to the NAVDA
annual meeting.
Yeah. So you gonna do any hunting while you're there?
I won't have a dog. I'll be flying.
I'm so sure there's plenty of people at the NAVDA annual meeting that have a dog.
Yeah. That means I have
you
to
could
pack
go
a
hunting
gun.
With. Yeah.
They did say something about that. I'm sure somebody will sneak out and do something, quail or chukar or something.
Yeah.
But we'll see.
Cool. Anything else you want to add? Late season?
No.
Get out there, get after it. It's cold, but we don't have much time left.
Yep. It goes so fast.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Bird Dog Babe Podcast.
Thank you to the Funchos, Peel, Poopin, Bosh, Satchels, Onyx, Hunt, Simon, USA, and Cody TV.
Don't forget, support the conservation organizations and the birds you're chasing after and the public land which you hunt.